Iowa trying to get to the Final Four for the third time in program history. Clark evades. That will do it. This time, it's Iowa. The Hawkeyes are headed back to the Final Four.
Rematch of last year's national championship game, Iowa beating LSU in the regional final, Albany Regional 2, I should say. As Iowa won that one 24-13 third quarter to create separation, a 94-87 win over LSU in that regional final. Caitlin Clark was outstanding with 41 points, 13-29 from the floor, 9-20 from three-point land, added 12 assists and 7 rebounds as Iowa is back to the Final Four here in 2024. Welcome into the Sports Ticket, brought to you by Kiefer Brothers Automotive in Beloit. They're your home team for fast and friendly auto repair, so check them out there south of Courthouse in Beloit. Check them out online at kieferbrothers.com as well, and a big thanks to them for bringing you the Sports Ticket here on Katy Country 94 and katycountry94.com. Still to come on the Sports Ticket, we'll be joined by Ryan Isbell, the head coach of the Beloit track and field teams, here momentarily to preview the 2024 season, so be listening for that. Also, we will preview what else is going on today in local sports. Spring sports assignments have been announced by the Kansas State High School Activities Association. The Royals made a comeback, but ultimately lost to the Orioles on Monday. And there's a no-hitter in Major League Baseball as well, an early season one we'll tell you about. And then, again, we'll update you on the Women's Final Four in the NCAA Tournament. Also, another champion from Kansas in the NJCAA we'll talk about. And what a wild finish it was there in Casper, Wyoming, last night. And then we'll wrap the Sports Ticket with some Chiefs notes, an update on Rashee Rice and his situation with that wreck and crash that happened, the chain reaction six-vehicle crash there in Dallas that had a vehicle that was reportedly registered to Rashee Rice involved. And the Chiefs have also signed a new backup quarterback who's had a lot of I'm going to say a lot of success, but he's been a starter in the NFL for a few years, a lot of years to start his career, but had some injuries that kind of derailed that. So we'll talk about that coming up here in the Sports Ticket on Katy Country 94. Now, before we get to the spring sports that are happening today, we're really kind of wrapping up the final for sure thing that we wanted to see from All-State Basketball, and that was the Kansas Basketball Coaches Association, as they released their All-State teams yesterday. And no surprise, a couple of Beloit players that are on the list, and Bryce Beisner has been a 3A Boys Player of the Year by Sports in Kansas and also the Wichita Eagle, and he's now a first-team All-State selection in Class 3A by the KBCA as well. Bryce Beisner for Beloit, again, had an outstanding season, and many people thinking he was the best in 3A, and again, is on another first-team ballot here by the Kansas Basketball Coaches Association here in 2024. Eli Johnson of Beloit, a second-place or second-team selection, I should say, there for the KBCA on the boys' side. So Bryce Beisner, first team. Eli Johnson, second team for the Trojans and 3A boys. And 3A girls, Peyton Remus of Beloit was an honorable mention, All-State pick. And then in 1A Division 1 boys, Johnny Hamill of Osborne, second team. 1A Division 2 boys, Edward Herenick of St. John's Tipton was on the third team. Moving back to 1A Division 2 girls, Carly Brummer of St. John's Tipton, a first team selection. Jenna Gingler was a second team pick. And Linnell Gingler, honorable mention for St. John's Tipton there in the KBCA All-State teams. Cameron Ritzke of Thunder Ridge, honorable mention. Brianna Reeves of Pike Valley was honorable mention as well there in 1A Division 2. And in 1A Division 1 girls, Gracie Reiner of Osborne was a second team All-State pick. The full All-State teams can be found at nckssports.com. There was definitely some other representation from the North Central Activities Association, especially on the boys' side. Again, they had four teams that qualified for state, so they definitely have some reps there on the All-State teams. You can find all the All-State and All-Class teams at nckssports.com. That KBCA boys All-State team, kind of giving an update on maybe some other names that you'll know on there. In Class 2A from Sacred Heart, Michael Matucci was a second-team pick, and also Max Ehrlich on the third team. Evan Bogart, an honorable mention selection in Class 2A. And moving on to 3A, we told you already about Bryce Beisner, Beloit on the first team. Will Cravens of Ellsworth, obviously a first-team selection as well. That one was pretty clear and an easy pick there. Also, second team for KBCA on the boys' side, Southeast Salines, Gannon Jacobson. That rounded out league teams there on the boys' side. And then girls All-State teams of note that are on these teams. So we told you about all the 1A players that are on those teams. Class 2A, Dakota Kattenberg of Smith Center is a second team all KBCA selection. So congratulations to Dakota Kattenberg there in Class 2A girls as well. Second team KBCA All-State. And that kind of wraps it up. There wasn't anybody from the NCAA, it doesn't look like, on the 3A girls team or 2A girls here in 2024. Again, you can find that full look at all KBCA All-State at ncksports.com. Again, coming up momentarily, we'll be joined by Ryan Isbell, the coach of the Beloit Trojan track and field teams. First, let's tell you the activities that are going on today. The St. John's Invitational at track and field is in Beloit at 3 o'clock this afternoon. St. John's, Lakeside, Osborne, Rock Hills, Tipton, Thunder Ridge, Southern Cloud, Lincoln, and Smith Center, Lincoln, and Sylvan Lucas is what I meant to say, not Smith Center. Let's redo that. St. John's, Lakeside, Osborne, Rock Hills, Tipton, Thunder Ridge, Sylvan Lucas, Lincoln, and Southern Cloud are the teams from the area that are competing. A lot of them today here at the St. John's Invitational this afternoon. They're talking possible snow and rain, not real thick or a lot of it. So it would appear that they'll be able to get that meet in. It might be a little breezy and a little cooler, but who knows? There was one year, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, but it was windy as all get out there. And very chilly at that St. John's Invitational. There was a year that it was raining at the St. John's Invitational, I remember. The early season track meets, you just are always subject to some tough weather. Spring sports is not really spring when it starts. Let's just put it that way. It's tough to get everything in. Again, Beloit will be at the Clay Center Invitational this afternoon at 3 o'clock. We'll hear more from Ryan Isbell coming up on that. High school golf, the Smith Center Invitational has actually been moved to Phillipsburg. So if you're headed to Smith Center, go another half hour to Phillipsburg. If you're wanting to go out to golf today, it starts at 1 o'clock. Beloit, Lakeside, Osborne, Rock Hills, and Smith Center are all opening their seasons today in golf. We hope to talk with some golf coaches down the line as well. And in baseball and softball today in the North Central Activities Association Beloit at Minneapolis. First pitch at 4 o'clock for both baseball and softball today. So that's what's going on here. Full spring sports schedules can be found at ncksports.com. Again, Beloit opening their season in track and field today at the Clay Center Invitational. And Ryan Isbell joins us now. Welcome back on the Sports Ticket on Katy Country 94, katycountry94.com. Ryan Isbell joining us now, the coach of the Beloit Trojan track and field teams. Well, Coach, you were supposed to start your season about a week ago, but the weather said no to that, and so now you open out today at the Clay Center Invitational, which was what you were supposed to have there a week ago. So you do open the season, and a lot of hope for especially your girls. You've got 10 returning state qualifiers, and then Tatum Seifert was a defending state champion in the 3A girls shot put and discus, and Addie Budke's back in the shot after a second place finish last year. Your throws look good. Obviously, your sprints look good as well, as you qualified a lot of different girls for state in a lot of different spots in the field and on the track last year, and they're all coming back. On the boys' side, really, Eli Johnson's your only returning state qualifier placer. But we'll look at the girls first. How are they looking here early on with obviously a lot of talent and some good numbers on that side?
Yeah, you hit most of it there, Dusty. The season's just been kind of a weird start, so the practices have been, we've had some really great days and then some really crummy days like you have in the spring around here. And like you said, this meet was supposed to be a week ago, so we would have learned a little bit more, but instead it's just been more practices and dodging some weather and having to be inside and doing some various things. But overall, the kids are working their tail off. A lot of them are pretty hungry from, like you said, the 10 girls that are back from state last year. They're pretty hungry to get back there and to do a little more than that. And it's not just those 10, it's all of them that are working hard and have a big picture in mind at the end of May. We have 34 girls out total, so you bring those 10 back plus a mix of some others that just missed out from making it to state, plus mm-hmm. you add in some others with some young freshmen, getting Sophia Thompson to where she's actually eligible to compete at the varsity level.
Mm-hmm.
So just adding a few more bits and pieces to what we have. And like I said, as long as they stay healthy, they're working hard. It's a fun group, both boys and girls. They're a fun crew to coach every day. They're ones that give you kind of a hard time at practice when you give them what their workout's going to be, but when it comes time to do it, they do it. And like I said, they've got that hunger, I think, to finish something. And obviously we got to start it and see where we're at and then kind of progress from there.
You have 21 boys you're telling me that are out as well, and I think from what I've heard, you've got a couple maybe seniors that are out this year that hadn't been out in the past and can add some numbers for you there. As I mentioned, Eli's really the only state qualifier in placer, but I'm sure you're looking for a lot of success on that side as well, right?
Yeah. You know, we would like to have more boys out if we could, but, you know, that's the way it is, and they get divvied up through a lot of different sports, and that's great that they're active and out doing something. Mm-hmm. We did add, we have probably, you know, 21, 22 out, and that's probably six more than what we had last year. So, you know, we're up a little bit there. And like you said, a couple that came out that were seniors that we didn't necessarily anticipate coming out at all, and they can definitely help in some areas, and they're working just as hard as everybody else, even though it might be their first time out for high school track. Eli coming back, finished well, placed in both the shot and the disc last year at state, and you know, just the seasons he's had this year, you can just see his progression mm-hmm. with his quickness and his strength and everything, and that'll carry right over into his shot and disc events this year also. So looking for big things from him also, and you know, they're a good group of leaders too. So some of these younger kids that are out, they're following in some pretty good footsteps there.
What does this Clay Center invite look like today as far as competition that you're expecting to see?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a little different than what it would have been had it been a week ago. It's still an unlimited entry event, which we love to start the year off with because everybody gets to go, everybody gets a mark, and then we can kind of see where we're at. Everybody's competing on the you know, the same type of conditions, so you can get a good comparison to find out who your next four are that get to go to the meet in Concordia on Thursday. Mm-hmm. But as far as the teams, you know, I don't have the list in front of me. I know Minneapolis is there, Clay Center, us, Concordia. Lynn was supposed to go, but I think with the movement of days, that they, I think, maybe are opting not to. And, in fact, Minneapolis, I think, is going to bring a pretty limited squad because of that. So, you know, it's always a smaller meet, which is good because it's unlimited entries. It's going to take a while to get through everything. But, you know, pushing this meet back to now is these next 3 weeks are going to be pretty hectic. I mean, we're going to get five meets in these 3 weeks by the time we go Tuesday, Thursday, Tuesday, Friday. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be pretty chaotic. But, you know, like I already mentioned, it's a great way, great opportunity for the kids to get out and get their marks and see where they're at and move forward from there.
Ryan Isbell, coach of the Beloit Trojan track and field teams. Coach, we certainly thank you for some time here to preview the season and wish you the best of luck here in 2024.
Yep, appreciate it as always, Dusty. Thank you.
Again, Beloit opening out at Clay Center this afternoon at 3 o'clock in track and field. Track and field regionals were announced, assignments on Monday, and Beloit will be hosting a 3A regional on Thursday, May 16th, as they'll host a host of teams. 16 total will be at that regional. Actually, all of our regionals are slated and scheduled for that Thursday, May 16th, and I know that Keisha likes to do that and have those scheduled on Thursday, one, because you can get them done on Thursday if you have the chance to, and you know, you're starting to get toward the end of the year there. Some schools are already out. Some schools would have seniors out in graduations, and then that's the final week of the regular school year for the rest of their kids, and get that done on Thursday. And the biggest and best reason to have it scheduled for Thursday is just in case there's weather, you can move that to Friday and have it there instead of having to move it from Friday to Thursday and then have to scramble and get things going and moved up a day where you've already got it scheduled for that Thursday, and then you can just go ahead and move it on to Friday if the weather is bad on the Thursday and vice versa there. So, again, Beloit hosting 3A. All of our Area 1A teams will be at Washington County on May 16th, and then Smith Center and Lincoln will be at the 2A Regional in Hill City on May 16th. Regional golf assignments on Monday, May 13th. Beloit's 3A at Norton, and 2A Smith Center's at Hill City, and then 1A Osborne is at Rollins County. And then, again, there's no Sand Greens regionals. You just have to hit a certain score to qualify for state in Sand Greens golf with the rest of our area teams there. Regional baseball, May 9th through 14th. Beloit and Sylvan Lucas Lincoln will be at the Marysville Regional in 3A. And regional softball, May 13th and 14th. 3A Beloit will be at Hoisington. And Sylvan Lucas is hosting a 2-1A regional there on the girls' side there. May 13th through 14th. So that's a look at what's going on local sports-wise. If you want to see all the teams that are involved in those regional assignments that I mentioned, see who you might be competing against if your favorite team's in one of those regionals, you can always check all those assignments out. There's one story posted with a link to all of those, kind of a hub there for spring sports postseason assignments at nckssports.com. Again, that's your home for all of the latest in local sports here in North Central Kansas. All right, we shift our attention now to baseball as the Royals were back in action and things went a little tough for him.
Westberg in his 71st career game, searching for his first career walk-off. Right side from Westberg, that ball driven deep, that ball at the wall, that ball is a game winner! Westberg with a wild, wild walk-off! Orioles win it 6-4!
Yeah, a walk-off home run for the Orioles after the Royals had fought their way back into the game. They were up 3-0 early as they got some power from Bobby Witt Jr. and Salvador Perez. Witt had a solo homer and a two-run shot from Perez, gave the Royals a 3-0 lead. Those three runs came in the third inning. And then in the bottom of the fourth inning, Baltimore was able to get back in it and tie the game up at 3. And then took a 4-3 lead in the eighth inning. Royals were able to scratch out a couple runners and a sac fly from Michael Garcia, brought in Dyron Blanco to tie the game at 4 going into the bottom of the ninth inning. And that's when you just heard the home run, the walk-off for Jordan Westberg. And, again, the Orioles pick up the victory over the Royals there on Monday evening. So again, that's a look at the Royals. They're now 1-3. The Orioles 3-1. A fight from his team, but Royals manager Matt Quatrero, it's just kind of tough to lose a game like that.
It was a really good ball game throughout. It was exciting to get back and tie it off. Kimbrel, he's one of the best closers in recent history. And obviously to lose in that fashion is heartbreaking. But like we've said, that's a good team. It's a good lineup up and down, and they beat us.
They did, and again, it's a battle. You fight, you try to get things done the right way, and man, the pitching has been decent here to start the season. We talked about it yesterday with the first three starters, a sub-1 ERA, but I want to say the pitching was bad yesterday, but the final line for Michael Walker, who made his official Royals debut there last evening, was 5 innings, 3 runs, 3 hits. He did walk 1, struck out 5. Still not a terrible start there for Michael Walker, obviously, but the Royals were tied at 3 when he left the game, so it's a no decision for him. And then the loss ends up in the hands of Nick Anderson, who gave up that home run there at the end of the game to Westberg, the walk-off for the Orioles in the end. Offensively, Bobby Witt Jr. is off to a very good start here this year. Again, another home run there last night. Through the first four games, he is hitting .500. Went 2-for-5 with the homer and the RBI and a run scored there last night. So Bobby Witt Jr., the guy that got the big contract and the long-term contract of the offseason, is looking pretty good to start the 2024 campaign for the Royals. So we'll keep an eye on that, and obviously a great start for him. Salvador Perez with a second home run in as many days, and he's hitting just .250 early, but again, another nice game for him and a nice start to the season there with a couple homers for Perez. Now you need to turn it into wins as the Royals are 1-3. Again, the Orioles 3-1. Game 2 of the 3-game series in Baltimore tonight. 5:35 first pitch between the Orioles and Royals, as it will be the debut start of the season for Alec Marsh of the Royals. Cole Irvin will pitch for the Orioles here this evening. Again, it's a 5:35 first pitch tonight from Baltimore. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll tell you about another feat in Major League Baseball. We'll recap the women's Final Four, or women's Elite Eight in the national tournament. Another Kansas national champion, and we'll finish the sports ticket with some Chiefs news and notes here on Katy Country 94 Sports Ticket, brought to you by Kiefer Brothers Automotive in Beloit.
I'm Elijah at Kiever Brothers Automotive in Beloit. Did you know that we sell tires? We also perform alignments and all the other services that go along with them. We handle all the top brands, extras like road hazard warranty, complimentary tire rotations, and complimentary tire repairs are available for purchase on most tires. Right now, we are offering $80 off when you buy a set of four. Call or stop by Kiever Brothers Automotive for fast, friendly tire services today. Find us just south of the courthouse in Beloit or on the web at KieverBrothers.com.
All right, Kiever Brothers Automotive again bringing you the sports ticket on Katy Country 94.
Ground ball. Dubon throws to first. No hitter. Renaud Blanco in his eighth career start. The 30-year-old makes magic on April Fool's Day.
His eighth career start. That's wild. Looking at what happened last night, it's the earliest no-hitter in history. Major League by date in Major League Baseball history there, and it's an unlikely guy to get a no hitter again amid the commotion that typically follows no hitter. Ronel Blanco's mother made her way through the excited crowd of the front row of seats above the Astros dugout trying to get her son's attention. It wasn't easy to do considering everybody on the field was giving him hugs and high fives, but they eventually locked eyes on mom, motioned her to come to the field where they shared an embrace that meant more than anyone would ever know. Blanco was working part-time at a car wash in 2016 in his native Dominican Republic to help his support his mother Maria who, when he was signed by the Astros, a former infielder who switched to pitching at 18 years old. He visited several academies in the Dominican Republic before the Astros eventually signed him for $5,000, pitched the game of his life on Monday night at Minute Maid Park. There's no doubt about that. Just his eighth career start, like we said, it's the 17th no-hitter in franchise history as the Astros won 10-0 over the Blue Jays. He did walk two batters, so he didn't get the perfect game just by two walks, but he struck out seven, obviously didn't allow any runs or any hits in the game, getting the no-hitter. Again, the first no-hitter of the 2024 season and the earliest ever by date in Major League Baseball history. Blanco said through an interpreter, quote, "It's been a very long road travel for me, lots of ups and downs, a lot of falls and me getting back up, but I think all of that has been worth it for me to be able to get to this moment." Again, only his eighth Major League start. And he wouldn't even, if you look at what's going on with the Astros, and by the way, they started the season 0-4, so this was their first win of the season after they got a four-game sweep by the Yankees opening the season, but he would not even be in the rotation to start the year if it's not for injuries to Justin Verlander and Jose Urquidy. He was told last week by manager Joe Espada that he'd have the final spot in the rotation, and it was on the same day that he and his wife welcomed their second child, so he just became a father for the second time less than a week ago, and now he's got a no-hitter. What a story there for Blanco, Ronel Blanco, the first no-hitter of the 2024 season. Again, as the Astros went 10-0, a shutout of the Blue Jays. Again, Blanco, seven strikeouts. He threw 105 pitches on the night. So, you know, a lot of these pitchers aren't going over 100 in a start, but kind of the way it is right now, 105 is not, it's not ridiculous, right? It's not normal. A lot of pitchers, like I say, aren't going over 100 anymore, just the way baseball is being played now. But, you know, when you're in a zone like that and you're looking for a no-hitter, most of the time, a young guy like that that has a chance to do something unbelievably special is going to take advantage of that. So, again, Ronel Blanco gets a no-hitter in just his eighth career start for the Astros again there last night. All right, again, baseball going on. Royals tonight, 5:35 against the Orioles, game two of a three-game set. We'll have more baseball talk as we get to the point where there's not much else going on, but there's actually quite a bit going on right now. We're in the heart of the NCAA tournament with the Final Four on the women's and men's side. The Final Four actually starting tonight in the NIT, and I might give those matchups coming up here momentarily, but the talk of the town last night and the talk of the nation last night was women's basketball, and there were two NCAA tournament games, and there was a JUCO national championship game that had an unreal ending. I was watching that one last night, and it was wild. We'll tell you about that coming up here on the sports ticket. But first, let's recap the Final Four, or the Elite Eight, I should say. The four teams are set for the Final Four in women's hoops. And yesterday, Wade and I were talking about these matchups, and It was Iowa against LSU, USC against UConn, and I had picked Iowa and USC. Wade, I believe, picked LSU. I know he picked LSU, and I'm pretty sure he picked UConn to win as well. We can't all be right all the time, but we can split, right? Iowa winning last night over LSU. And UConn beat USC. This Iowa-LSU game was one we were talking about. I just had to, you're looking at these teams. Iowa had four losses. LSU had five. You look at the matchup and think that, well, it's a one seed versus a three. But like Wade had said, LSU obviously didn't start the season the way they would have liked to. Lost to Colorado to start the year. And Angel Reese missed some games during the season, and they were never really all the way themselves until later. And they showed that they, had a lot of the same form as they did last year when they won a national championship. Haley Van Lith helping that team, obviously, offensively, coming into the squad. But I just had kind of a gut feeling that Iowa was going to come out zoned in and ready to go, and especially Caitlin Clark. After what happened last year in the national championship game, they picked up the upset win over South Carolina, then made it to the national championship against LSU and ended up losing that game, fairly this wasn't an easy win for LSU, but Iowa just didn't have the defense to keep up with LSU last year in that game. And so you're looking at it this year, and people have to step up. One person can't do it by themselves, and I understand that and understood that going into last night's game. There's one of the things that you look at with Iowa is I don't think they're as physical as they were last year. But they have developed into a team that understands what their strengths are. And obviously the top strength on Iowa's team is Caitlin Clark. And that shows through when you score 41 points in a game like this. Caitlin Clark came out and hit a three, right at the start of the game and just really set the tone right away. Now, LSU did fight back and ended up leading 31-26 after the first quarter, but the game was tied at halftime. And then Iowa used a 24-13 third quarter to create a little separation there and get away from LSU there in the end. LSU fought back and got back within a possession, I think, a couple times there late. I don't have the play-by-play right in front of me, but they didn't go away easily, we'll say that, LSU. But, again, Iowa made the plays down the stretch, and the important things that they needed to do were done. Again, Caitlin Clark with 41 points. She was 13 of 29 from the floor, 9 of 20 from three-point land, and 12 assists, as well as 7 rebounds. And I just felt like that Caitlin Clark was going to come out and put on a performance like that. When you look at, the greats, and I still will say what Wade said yesterday, LSU is a more athletic team. LSU is, I think, from top to bottom, definitely a better basketball team as far as skill is concerned. But when you're talking about the greats, and when you have a player like that, and we're going to talk about another player that's probably not going to get as much credit as she should here today because of what Caitlin Clark did last night. But when you have the greats like that, and they're in these situations, these are their opportunities to show why they're great, why Caitlin Clark right now is considered one of the greatest players, or may be the greatest women's basketball player ever. That'll be up for debate. People my age will say Diana Taurasi, maybe Brittany Griner would maybe be in somebody's conversation. I don't know all the players that are going to be listed in that conversation. They were kind of talking about that last night. Cheryl Swoops, for me, when I was very, very young, she was considered like the Michael Jordan of women's basketball when she was playing. And so there's obviously Lynette Woodard in this state, in Kansas, would be a name that would come to mind for a lot of people. But my point being is if the greats separate themselves, these are the kinds of performances they have, and these are the kind of performances they need to have and want to have when they're in these situations. And Iowa's coming into this game after a loss to LSU last year in the national championship where they didn't feel they played their best game, obviously, and they went out and wanted to prove a point. Again, Caitlin Clark can't do it by herself. And Hannah Stolke had a 40-point game earlier this year, and I was like, maybe she can step up and do some things. Angel Reese kind of and the LSU bigs kind of eliminated that part of it, but Iowa was able to hit some key threes. Kate Martin, I know, hit one, and Sydney Affelter hit a couple threes as well. And You know, the 41-12-7 from Caitlin Clark is huge, but the 21-6 from Kate Martin is huge. The 16 points from a Falter is huge for Iowa, and somebody else has to step up and do those things and hit timely shots. Caitlin Clark did most of that, obviously, with 41 points, but Kate Martin did it. A Falter did it. You know, they all did it for Iowa at some point. And even, you know, Gabby Marshall only had one three-pointer, but it was an early run for Iowa that was an important shot for him. And she finished with just 3 points. But, you know, you've got to trust and get other contributions from other people. And if you can do that, then you'll have that success. And that's what Iowa did last night. They came out, and I think they were zoned in early. You know, they weathered that run from LSU that put them back ahead. And Angel Reese, by the way, last night was outstanding with 17 points, 20 rebounds, a 14-14 game for Anissa Morrow. And then, you know, Flajay Johnson led the way with 23. For LSU, Michaela Williams had 18. So their scoring was obviously more balanced than Iowa's. And that proves probably the point of this is probably a better and deeper team all around as far as talent, athleticism, and all those things that are combined. But when you have a great, when you have one of the best, when you have a LeBron James on your team that can lead a Cleveland Cavaliers team in 2007 that wasn't that good to the NBA Finals, when you have a Michael Jordan on your team that can fight and battle through everything and get you to the Finals and win games, when you have Steph Curry on your team, when you have the greats on your team, a KD for the Warriors when he joined all of that, right? When you have those kind of players on your team, They can overcome a very, very good squad that's on the other side, but they can't do it themselves. And if anybody tries to tell you that Caitlin Clark did it herself last night, tell them to look at the box score. But Caitlin Clark obviously rose above everybody else last night with her 41-point, 12-assist, 7-rebound performance. That tells you right there that Caitlin Clark didn't do it all for her team as far as scoring. She had 12 assists. And so, you know, everybody's going to focus on that 41, rightfully so, but understand that Caitlin Clark is getting her teammates involved, and last night they were knocking down important shots for her team. Iowa moves on, to the Final Four, where they will face UConn, who's making their 23rd appearance in the Final Four. Iowa, by the way, is now 33-4. LSU was the defending national champion, but no more. They finished their year at 31-6. Again, Iowa gets that win, a big win for Iowa, to move themselves back into the Final Four as they made it there last year. And UConn, again, making it to the Final Four. And the other side of the bracket, Paige Beckers, again, this is who I'm talking about that I was talking about earlier, that's not probably going to get the credit that she deserves because the story right now is Caitlin Clark and everything that she did last night with the 41 points to lead her team to victory. But I tell you what, don't overlook Paige Beckers, who's had multiple injuries during her career and didn't even know if she was going to be able to come back and be the same type of player. But what an outstanding game she had. Also a double-double, 28 points, 10 rebounds, 6 assists, 3 steals, and a couple block shots as well for Paige Beckers for UConn, helping lead them to the Final Four again for the 23rd time this season. UConn made a run. USC actually had tied the game, and then UConn made a run to pull it back away. They end up winning it by 7, 80-73, as USC was the number one seed in that region. They both had 5 losses, though. UConn was 34-5, and USC came into that game with a record of 29-5. USC was the number one seed. UConn the number 3 seed in that bracket, and UConn again getting the victory in Portland there last night. The court was right, the court was not right, but the links for the 3-point lines were the same. It still looked like it was wrong, but they just moved the line and the pre-made. This is what I don't get about that court thing. These things are pre-made, so like, and there's like a faded shaded area inside the 3-point arc, right? And it's like, how do you miss that when you actually have to shade or fade the wood grain court? It's probably just paint, but you get my point that it's a different color than what's outside the 3-point line at half court and all that. And it's like, how do you mess up the distance from the 3-point lines if you're doing a custom court like that? And it didn't happen anywhere else, just happened in Portland. So it still looked awkward last night because there was a fade and then there was the normal wood color and then the 3-point line on one end of the floor. But it was the fade, the 3-point line, and then the normal wood color on the other side. But they at least fixed that. A combined 16 three-pointers were made, all from the same distance in that game between UConn and USC. But again, what a game from Paige Beckers. 28 points, 10 rebounds, 6 assists. She's leading her team back to the Final Four for the 23rd time under Gino Auriemma. I'm not trying to make anybody mad here. There was a question that asked last night on ESPN on their Twitter page. They asked, there was a poll question that said, who has the better program in their history? Is it UConn women's basketball or Kansas men's basketball? Objectively, UConn's been to 23 Final Fours and won 11 championships. Kansas has won 4 actual NCAA tournament national championships and 2 more that they claim. So they've got 6 national championships that they claim at Kansas, 11 at UConn, and 23 Final Four appearances. Objectively, if you're actually just asking the question, UConn has the best program of any college basketball team in history. UCLA, I guess, might be actually up there as far as championships would be concerned. But the amount of wins that they have and all that goes into that, it's UConn. And UConn was getting most of the votes, clearly, in that poll. Listen, Kansas basketball is one of the best ever on the men's side of things. There's no question about that. Might be the best program ever in men's basketball history. But, again, objectively, it's UConn. And that question was absurd to me. First of all, I don't like the question because you're comparing two different sports like we talked about yesterday, right? You're saying women's basketball, men's basketball. It's two different things. And you're comparing Caitlin Clark to Pete Maravich and things like that. So you're comparing two different sports, but it's like that's not a question. It's not a real question if you're objectively looking at it. And I'm getting a text that agrees with me there. It's really not close. And, you know, KU fans might not like that I say it, but if you look at it the right way and understand that question on the surface, then you know. UConn is back to the Final Four with a team that, you know, I don't think a lot of people thought was going to make the Final Four this year. And Wade got that one right. Said UConn would beat USC, and that's what they did. 24 points last night for Aaliyah Edwards for UConn as well. Again, 28-10, 6 assists, 28 rebounds, 28 points, 10 rebounds, 6 assists for Paige Beckers. Neither UConn nor Iowa has a lot of production from their bench. But they both picked up wins last night, and they will meet in the semifinals of the NCAA tournament coming up in the Final Four. It's in Cleveland this year, so that's where the Final Four will be. UConn and Iowa. USC, Judy Watkins had 29 points, 10 rebounds in her final game of her freshman year there for USC, and also a 24-point outing from Mackenzie Forbes for the Trojans. So USC getting things rolling and getting a good start to a possible program builder here this year with Juju Watkins. I don't think she can leave. She could, I guess, go into the transfer portal, but I would imagine she's going to be back at USC next year. So that's something for USC fans and their program to look forward to. But again, UConn continuing their impressive program performance with another Final Four here in 2024. Again, UConn will play Iowa and the other side of South Carolina against NC State. I'm going to tell you when those games are and where those games are here. Once I pull that up, it'll start on Friday in Cleveland. And the first semifinal will be South Carolina against NC State at about 6 o'clock on ESPN. And I can promise you this game's not starting at 8 o'clock, but that's what's listed. UConn against Iowa in the second national semifinal. 2-3s and 2-1s in the Final Four. South Carolina is still obviously the favorite here at 36-0. Everybody else has 4 or more losses going into the Final Four. South Carolina has had some scares. They've had to fight through some games, but they've won them all going into the Final Fours. Again, they're 36-0. And a chance to finish the year at 38-0 with another national championship. We're looking forward to keeping an eye on that. There was a national champion crowned last night in Casper, Wyoming.
37-0. The Blue Dragons breathe fire in Casper. Hutchinson is the 2024 NJCAA Division I champion for the first time in program history.
This game was wild. The Jayhawk Conference winning another national championship last night as Hutchinson beats Northwest Florida State. You heard it there. 88-80 was the final in overtime. I was actually, I wasn't intently watching it the whole night, but You know, I watched most of Barton's win. By the way, the Jayhawk Conference winning both national championships as Barton won on Saturday over Triton Community College just outside of Chicago. That was in Hutchinson on Saturday. Barton picked up the win to win the men's national championship in the NJCAA from the Jayhawk Conference. And then Hutchinson repeats that and gets the sweep of the NJCAA Division I championships with the win 88-80 over Northwest Florida State. Northwest Florida State was the defending national champion, and I'm sitting watching this game, and I was, you know, Hutchinson got out to like a 13-point lead at one point in the second half, and it looked like, you know, they were going to be fine. It might have been the first half. Anyway, they were up by 13. Hutch was, and they're 36-0, you know. Number one seed in this tournament looked like they're cruising to their first ever national championship, and all of a sudden that run happens from Northwest Florida State, and I'm, you know, as I'm talking to you right now, I told you Northwest Florida State, the defending national champion, so they've been here before. They know what it takes to get there, and Hutch is looking for their first ever national title, much like Barton was on Saturday on the men's side. And so you're sitting here, and there's their run for Northwest Florida, and they come in, they take the lead, and it's late in the game, and they lead. And, you know, Hutch is fighting, trying to get back into the game, and so it's 68-66. And there's a foul by Hutch. Obviously, the clock's starting to run down, and they're in foul mode at this point. So they get the foul, 2.5 seconds left on the clock, and headed to the free throw line is Celia Rivière, if I'm saying her, Rivière. I don't know how to say her name for sure, from Northwest Florida State. But anyway, she goes to the line. It's 68-66. Heads to the free throw line, hits the first one. It is 69-66, 2.5 seconds left in the game. All she's got to do is make the second free throw, and this thing's on ice. You know, you're either icing a four-point win, or you're icing a one-point win because Hutch made a shot that didn't mean anything at the end on a three-pointer from half court or something, or maybe even you get take the timeout, get to the three-point line, and make the three, and you still lose by one. Or Northwest Florida State in this situation wins by one, and they get their second straight national championship. It looked like that's what was going to happen, right? And then Rivière missed the second free throw. Hutch, quick rebound, boom, timeout to advance the ball. That's why you save those timeouts in women's basketball, because you can advance that ball to half court. And they advanced the ball after the timeout. For some reason, no time went off the clock on the rebound, so it stayed at 2.5. So the coach for Northwest Florida State didn't understand that. Neither did I. So here's the age-old question. Do you foul up three, right? Do you foul up three, or do you let them take a three and a chance to tie it to send it into overtime? Well, in this scenario, both things happened, but not on purpose. Inbound play comes in for Hutch. They get it to Haley Jackson, who's had a big game and a great game already for Hutch. Haley Jackson gets the inbound. She's ready to rise and fire, goes up with the shot, gets hit on the left arm by Celia Rivière, who just missed the free throw that would have put the team up four. She gets hit on the arm, Haley Jackson does, and then goes to the free throw line with 0.7 seconds left, down 69-66. She has three free throws to tie the game. First two were smooth, like no problem at all. The third one rolls over the top, hits the front of the rim, and then spins down and in for her. And she ties the game with 0.7 on the clock. Northwest Florida State didn't even try to get a shot off. They had no timeouts, so they couldn't advance the ball. And so they were stuck. And it went to overtime, tied at 69. And Hutch came out of the gates fast. And they took as much as an 8-point lead. Probably about the midway point of the overtime, and then they finished with an 8-point lead with some free throws down the stretch and went at 88-80. But you just, that Celia Rivière, you just got to feel for her, because again, you've got the chance to ice it with a free throw and you miss that, and then just a bad decision to try to block a 3-pointer that was, I don't think, was going to even have a single chance of going in. Like it was a rush shot. It was not all that greatly lined up by Haley Jackson, but she put a hand up, or put a hand across. She needed to put her hands up is what the coach was saying, and she fouled out with that foul, by the way, and was not able to play in overtime, which, you know, hurt their chances as well. She did have 10 points and a bigger player on the inside that could have helped out there in the overtime frame, but she fouled out there, and the coach was just like, just put your hands up. You don't need to reach out. And she reached out and made contact with the arm. Three free throws, boom, we're tied at 69. And a 19-11 overtime for Hutch gives them an 88-80 win. It was a wild finish. If you have ESPN Plus, you can actually go back and watch the replay of it there. Just look for your schedule and replays and watch the end of that game. It might be on YouTube too. I don't know where it's all at, but what a wild finish it was. And Hutchinson gets their first ever national championship on the women's side in junior college basketball. Unfortunately, for Northwest Florida State, that's a loss that is hard to deal with when you have a 3-point lead and you foul, not on purpose, on the 3-pointer that is put up. And then they make three free throws and then you lose. Not only lose, but, I mean, you've got to be deflated going into that overtime. If you talk about momentum, I mean, obviously it's all on Hutch's side once they tip that overtime. And you're just ejected if you're Northwest Florida State after something like that happens. I was not surprised at all. I mean, I fully expected Hutch to win that game as it went to overtime because it was just like, how do you recover from that as a team and try to refocus yourself? You've missed some players that have fouled out now, and the one that fouled on the last play fouls out before overtime starts. Just all kinds of bad there. And you do feel for Northwest Florida State without question. But what a finish it was. It was something else to watch. But Hutch gets the national championship. And the Jayhawk Conference reigns supreme. A lot of people on Twitter last night saying, oh, the Jayhawk Conference rules JUCO basketball. And I'm sitting here, where you been? Listen, just because they're not winning championships every year doesn't mean that they haven't been ruling JUCO basketball for quite some time. From top to bottom as a whole, I lived it. I've known this for 23 years now because that's when I went to school at a junior college in the Jayhawk Conference. And when I was at school, we had men's and women's teams at Colby that were pretty good and competing for Region 6 championships. And I think a couple years after I graduated, our women made the national tournament. The men made it the COVID year and obviously didn't get a play in 2020 when they made it to the national tournament. And that was canceled. And unfortunately, they might not ever make it back. Who knows? But that's beside the point as a Colby grad and wanting my alma mater to do well. But I've seen guys from this league that made it to the, I went to school with a guy that made it to the NBA. And so it's not a surprise that the talent is there. And anybody that like just talks down on JUCO basketball because they're not good enough to qualify or they're not good enough to play at the D1 level because, oh, they just went to a JUCO. They can't be that good. Here's the thing. What I just said just a little bit ago, they couldn't qualify. And so there's a lot of people that end up at JUCOs that just simply didn't qualify and don't have the standards that are met to be signed on an NCAA roster. And so they go to community college where, let's face it, I've been there. Like I said, these classes are not the same as NCAA Division I institutions as far as difficulty is concerned. There's a basketball class if you're on the basketball team. Let's just put it that way. So it's a way to up your GPA. It's a way to up your numbers to get yourself qualified to go to the big leagues. And Coach O, when he was at Colby, was one of the best at finding men that were just so dang good, that were D1 talents from whether it be Milwaukee, Chicago, Charlotte, you know, Detroit. You just add the list. You know, Milwaukee and Chicago were the two really hotbeds that he went after. And the one that made it to the NBA was from Chicago, and I had a guy that I was in school with that played in Japan for several years and was an all-star over there and had a bobblehead made over there from Chicago, right? And you know, these guys are studs. The talent level on men's and women's in the Jayhawk Conference, if you've never gone to games and haven't seen it with your own eyes, I would encourage you to do so. Because the talent's there. They're as talented, or like I said the other day, maybe better. Like Barton might be able to beat a host of the lower Division I schools that are playing right now in the MEAC or whatever conference it might be. And Hutch on the women's side as well might be able to do that. And so the talent is there. It's just they've either, one, not gotten the opportunities they wanted at the D1 level, and they're going to JUCO to better those opportunities to show and prove that they've got the talent and what it takes to be at that level, or they didn't qualify, and everybody knows they have the talent, but they need to get better grades. And that's what JUCO's for. And that's what we've seen. So, again, JUCO being ruled by the Jayhawk Conference in Kansas, with Hutch women and Barton men both claiming their first ever national championships in college hoops. All right, we're going to wrap the sports ticket. Some notes from the Kansas City Chiefs after the six-vehicle chain reaction crash that took place in Dallas Saturday evening. Authorities were looking for Chiefs wide receiver Rashee Rice, as his Corvette was involved in a crash that was said to be registered to Rice, that Corvette. Almighty Rice's attorney Royce West said in a statement, quote, on behalf of Rashee Rice, his thoughts are with everyone impacted by the automobile accident on Saturday. Rashee is cooperating with local authorities and will take necessary steps to address the situation responsibly, unquote. Occupants of the Corvette and Lamborghini were said to have left the scene of the crash. It was not confirmed if Rice was present at the crash. Chiefs President Mark Donovan told KCMO Radio Monday, quote, in all these situations, you have to wait until you have the facts. And frankly, we do not have all the facts at this point. He went on to say, we'll get to the bottom of it. We'll gather the facts and we'll react accordingly. Everybody reacted not accordingly when this came out on Sunday or Saturday night into Sunday morning. Again, we don't know if Rashee Rice was there. There's been nothing confirmed. And obviously, the lawyers are not going to talk about that right now. If he was there, they're going to try to do the right things and make sure that he's protected. And obviously, they're going to do everything they can to keep Rashee Rice out of trouble. That's what the lawyers are for, right? That's why you have them. That's why you're paying them. We don't know much more than that. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what involvement Rashee Rice had there. I am interested in the comment of his thoughts are with everyone impacted by the automobile accident. I don't know if I call it an accident. It was maybe an accident for the people that were not involved in a high-speed race down a busy highway. I purposely not said accident in the way that I present the story because, you know, I don't know that that's an accident. You're doing some things that you shouldn't be doing. So, is what it is on that part of it. But, again, nobody was killed. There was, I think, one injury. Seems like everybody's fine. But it was a situation where a bunch of people left the scene of an accident. So, we'll see what happens in the end. But that's the latest on Rashee Rice. Nothing new as far as whether he was there or not. But he is cooperating with officials there in Dallas, is what has been told to everybody by his attorney. And finally, here on the sports ticket, we do have a new backup quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs, and it's a name that a lot of people are probably familiar with. Started his career in Philadelphia and had a decent start to his career, and then got injured, and Nick Foles took the team to a Super Bowl championship. But Carson Wentz is the new backup quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs. Based on yesterday's news, he signed a one-year contract with Kansas City. And Wentz, again, he got off to a good start. He was a Pro Bowler in his second year and actually was third in MVP voting that year. And that second year, he threw for 3,296 yards, 33 touchdowns, and just 7 interceptions. In his career, he's got 95 games that he's played. He started 93 of those games, and most of those starts were with Philadelphia. Early in his career, he started all 17 games he played in 2021 with the Colts, and just had no regard for his body. Took some injuries. He sprained both ankles on one play, if I remember correctly. 27 touchdowns, 7 interceptions there in that year, 3,563 yards. So actually more yards than he had in his year where he was third in MVP voting in 2017. He was a Pro Bowler that year, but then went to the Commanders last year. It didn't work out. He started 7 of 8 games that he played in, 11 touchdowns, 9 interceptions, just 1,755 yards. That was 2 years ago, actually. And then last year, he was a backup for the Rams behind Matthew Stafford. There, he started 1 game, played in 2. He went 17 of 24, 2 touchdowns passing, and also, I believe, had a touchdown running in a win over the 49ers in Week 18, where like none of the starters were playing for either team because they were both into the playoffs and wanted to rest as they went into the postseason. 49ers obviously ended up making it to the Super Bowl, where they lost to the Chiefs. But again, Carson Wentz has thrown for over 22,000, just under 23,000 yards in his career. Or 22,300, I should say. He's got 95 games that he played, 93 starts, 153 touchdowns, and 67 interceptions in his career. So this is a guy that knows the game. He's been on the field as a starter a lot, 93 of them, and he's coming to back up Patrick Mahomes in Kansas City. I don't have any complaints about it. I don't think Chiefs fans should. I mean, this is what the Chiefs try to do. They try to find guys that have started in this league at one point or another to come in and be a backup. That one, the reason you want to get guys that have started in this league is because they know how to play in this league and what it takes to be a starter in the league. But also, too, you would think that if they've started in the league this long, a guy like Carson Wentz that started 93 games in his career would be able to pick up plays and understand the game and what Andy Reid's trying to teach. So, again, I have no qualms with this. I think it's a great signing, to be completely honest with you, for a backup quarterback to have a guy like Carson Wentz coming in. So, again, there's no quarterback controversy, but, you know, it was released yesterday, like early, late evening last night it came out. Everybody's like, is this an April Fool's joke? We need to confirm this. They confirmed it. And so, again, it's not an April Fool's joke. There's no April Fool that there's a quarterback controversy between Patrick Mahomes and Carson Wentz. But Carson Wentz has been signed to a one-year contract to be the backup quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs. So we'll see how all that plays out. I hope Carson Wentz either doesn't play at all or just plays in Week 18 like he did last year, because the Chiefs have wrapped up maybe a number one seed in a first-round bye looking for a three-peat in the NFL for a Super Bowl championship again. Might be some stuff that hinges on Rashee Rice and what his situation is going to be as well. So we'll let it all play out. That's what you do, right? All the things that are going on, and you wait until football season starts and see if this is going to be another championship for the Kansas City Chiefs or not. We'll find out, but I do like the signing of Carson Wentz as a backup, a guy that's been in this league and started in this league and knows what it takes to play in this league and play at the highest of levels as he started 93 games. So looking forward to that. Looking forward to him not touching the field next year because Patrick Mahomes stays healthy all year. That's what everybody is hoping for, right, as the Chiefs look for a three-peat. That'll wrap it up for today. Have a great day, everybody.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or SunflowerStateRadio.com.